How does a large police department take care of its own? And how do they make sure that officers are well, healthy, and have the tools they need to thrive in their mental and physical well-being? Today on the podcast, my guest is Sergeant John Hadaway. He's a 24-year veteran of the Baltimore County Police Department and currently serves as the department's peer support and wellness manager. We talk about how his team supports the officers within the Baltimore County Police Department and how this unit came to be. So stay tuned for this informative conversation. Welcome to episode number 36 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast. This is the show where we talk about wellness and mental health within the first responder community. I believe that wellness is not optional. And if you want to prosper and thrive, then wellness must be a priority for you, no matter what you do. So the show is designed to bring you tips and tools on how to do that. My name is Conrad Weaver, and I'm grateful that you've joined us today. Thanks for taking time to listen or to watch this podcast. I really do appreciate it. Hey, if you're a first responder in Maryland, be sure to check out the upcoming screening events of PTSD 911 on May 15th in Owings Mills and May 23rd in La Plata, Maryland. The Owings Mills event is being sponsored by the Baltimore County Police Department. And John Hadaway, that we have on the show today, is a big part of that, of making that happen. And tickets are available on our website, PTSD911movie.com, for all of our events, so come check it out. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. I'm so grateful for everyone who's joining us on our YouTube channel. If you're on a podcast audio app like Apple Podcast, I want to invite you to also join us on YouTube, where you can watch this interview and all the others. Plus, we have a ton of additional content, including my series recap from our coast-to-coast bicycle tour this past summer. We rode from Astoria, Oregon to Ocean City, Maryland in support of first responders, and our YouTube series on the channel is highlighting those events. So come on over and subscribe to the Wellness Channel for First Responders on YouTube, and I'll see you there. Thanks again for listening and watching. And now here's my conversation with John Hadaway. Well, John, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. It's great to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you having me on to talk about a very important topic, peer support and wellness.
Yeah, so it's great to have someone from Maryland on the program today. So tell our audience a little bit about you. Where are you from and what do you do?
I am a 24-year veteran of the Baltimore County Police Department, located in Central Maryland. We surround Baltimore City. We also go all the way up to the Pennsylvania line. We are the 21st largest police department in the country.
Wow.
So I actually live out in the rural area, but we are a very interesting department because we have urban, suburban, and rural policing all in one place. So we get to see a little bit of everything.
It was interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking with my wife and we were talking about Baltimore County. I was like, yeah, I think it's only like, you know, around the city. And then I looked up on the map and I was like, oh, that goes all the way up to Pennsylvania. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that precinct is very interesting. It's the Cockeysville precinct. And what can happen is, I mean, if you get a call at the Pennsylvania line, it could take us 30 minutes running lights and sirens to get there just because of the amount of vast space that we have. And that's a very rural area with a lot of horse farms and other types of stuff. And then the further south you come, you start to surround the city, you start to have that urban policing where it's very high concentration, a lot of people, and a lot of really just different areas. You know, you go from poverty to extreme wealth in a matter of a couple of blocks.
Sure. Yeah. If you've never been to that part of Maryland, you know, there's some massive horse farms. I mean, you think of Lexington, Kentucky being, you know, the horse capital of the world. Well, this is the horse capital of Maryland. I mean, there's some amazing, beautiful farms out there and a lot of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're very fortunate to have that here. One of the horse farms up there is called Wellspring, and they actually provide equine therapy. So we partner with them a lot to have our officers and their families go up to interact with the horses, and they'll have demonstrations and provide food and comfort dogs and that sort of thing. So it's really a very great resource for us.
Yeah. So just to get a perspective for those who are watching, who are perhaps in law enforcement or first responders, what kind of incidents, calls do you guys typically get in a course of a day or a course of a week?
We often get up to 1,800 to 2,000 calls a day. We have 10 different precincts. Each precinct is larger than the average size police department in the United States. Most calls are, you know, minor crimes, thefts, a lot of domestic violence, unfortunately. But we often get larger scale calls of shootings and stabbings, violent crimes, and that sort of stuff. So we get the whole array. We get a little bit of everything, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And Baltimore City kind of takes care of the inner city part, like the actual urban part. They're kind of called that. Do you guys respond to those as well?
It's very unique here. Baltimore is one of, I believe, only four places in the country where the city is completely separate from the county. Mm-hmm. So the county has no jurisdiction in the city at all. Mm-hmm. The city is its own self-contained area. And Baltimore County itself does not have any smaller jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. So the Baltimore County Police Department handles all law enforcement functions in Baltimore County, with the exception of the state police handle some of the highways. Mm-hmm. And we have a few college police departments here.
Mm-hmm. So even some of the areas like up north, outside of the Baltimore city limits, you guys, they don't have their own police departments within those agencies, and you guys cover all that?
We cover everything. There are no no municipalities inside of Baltimore County. So Baltimore County is just one large municipality.
Okay. Awesome. So in the course of the years that you've worked there, I'm sure you've seen some stuff, and I'm sure your officers, the people you work with, have seen some stuff. So how do you handle that trauma, the vicarious trauma, the things that you guys see and face? How do you deal with that? And how has the agency handled those things historically?
So, I've been on 24 years. I was also in the Army infantry. So I come from a place of just shove it down, move on, don't talk about it. And, a lot of times that allows you to get that cumulative trauma build up, especially depending on what you see and what you've done in your life. Historically, it was very similar here. Decades ago when I started, even up to 10 years ago, it was like that. Luckily, the tide started to kind of change in the last 5 to 7 years, I'd say. We had a great sergeant here. His name was Chuck Hart. Still does great work at a place called Harbor of Grace in Havre de Grace, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And people would just call him randomly and say, "Hey, I'm having a tough time. Can you help me?" Mm-hmm. And he would go out organically, not as part of his actual official function. And he would go out and help these folks, whether it was meeting them at a diner at 2 o'clock in the morning, whether it was, you know, going to where they were while they were working or whatever had to happen. So he's really the father of our peer support program. COVID came around, and that allowed us. We had a chief at the time that wanted to put a more formal peer support team together. So around 2019, 2020 is when we kind of started to take that turn. We had about 5 core members. But unfortunately, I believe during that time, we didn't necessarily use the proper application of peer support. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a lot of force type stuff, even though it wasn't, and it was meant to help people. A lot of people took it that way. So building that trust and building that ability to get people to recognize that they need to seek that help if they're having trouble.
Was that kind of mandated from the top down? And that's why it kind of didn't develop into the way it should be?
It was. Mm-hmm. We did some stuff like wellness walks, but they were more, I'd say, of like a photo opportunity, a formalized. And, you know, it didn't really help a lot of people because they were mainly based at our headquarters, which didn't help anybody out in the field in the patrol functions.
Sure.
So my belief is you have to be out there to see the people and interact with the people. I still respond to calls when I'm going to and from. I still stop by on their traffic stops. I go to roll calls. And if you don't see them and you don't get to know them, they're not going to trust you, and they're not going to trust the information you're providing. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to build that trust. And I think we kind of lacked a little bit during that mm-hmm. time.
So what shifted? What made the shift to what you guys are doing now?
So we continued to work at it and work at it. The person that was here before me continued to kind of chip away at that feeling, if you will, of it being more of a force thing to being, this is beneficial for you, your family, and everyone else. We have some great programs that are in place where we touch you from the moment you start until the moment you retire and beyond. Mm. So on the family orientation day, all of the recruits leave, they go take a tour of our campus. And while they're out taking their tour, we're able to provide the family with stress management principles, resources they can use, things they may experience, changes they may see, and how they can kind of help mitigate that. And we give them our information. So if they see that and they're concerned, they can call us. And we've had that before where they've called and said, my first responder has changed. Is there something I can do? Is there a reason this is happening? And we can kind of work them through that.
I think that seems to be pretty unusual, at least historically, for law enforcement agencies to bring those family members in to kind of give them some of those tools. Because I mean, I've heard stories of people that we just didn't know what was going on with him and didn't, you know, had no clue.
Oh, absolutely. And when I started, it was a far different experience. They brought you into a room, and the first thing that happened while you're in there with your family is they turn out the lights and you hear somebody rack a shotgun, which was the lieutenant at the time. And he would then turn the lights on and he'd say, if you hear that, what would you do? And that's basically how it started. So you almost traumatize the people from the minute they start. And now, you know, it's more about making sure that they have support, that they're provided with the resources that they need and that their families are supported. So that way they have a long, healthy career that's good for them and their families. And we hope to see that reduction of law enforcement divorces and, you know, alcoholism and everything else. Because we actually had a retiree that came back for our peer support training and he said, you know, we don't hire alcoholics, but we sure do retire them. And unfortunately, he is correct in some aspects.
So what does that look like? What does your program look like, boots on the ground? How does that actually work for officers in the field and for perhaps someone who's struggling with alcoholism or struggling with depression or anxiety, things like that? What does that look like?
So it can come from a variety of ways. We have on our intranet or internal departmental website, we have a peer support tab where they can find resources, they can find videos, they can get all of our information. We go out to the precincts. Like I said, we touch them in the academy. We touch them during their supervisor's training. We try to go to their roll calls or stop by their units. And then we also make sure that I send out emails with all the information that they may need. So if they need help, they can call us directly. Sometimes we'll get a referral from a commander or a supervisor who will see the need and will bring us in to try and intervene. But the issue that we do have is that it's a two-party contract, right? So, I mean, absent being suicidal or homicidal or having a major issue, if you're trying to work through trauma, you know, it's upon you to try and take that step and say, okay, I'm going to work with you to do this and have that self-recognition. And a lot of people I find are still having that trouble with self-recognition. But if they do contact us, we have 32 members now. We just expanded the team. It was about 4 or 5 members previously, and they can call upon any of those members. We also have an on-site clinician through our employee assistance program. So that's a licensed clinician, so it's confidential. And then we also have a licensed clinical professional counselor that works for our department that also can assist.
Have you guys partnered with, and you mentioned a couple of them, but have you partnered with local resources in the community to help, you know, send officers to those areas to get additional help?
Yes, we have the Cortico app. And on that app, we have a whole list of therapists and different behavioral health specialists that they can call upon if they need to. We also have, like I said, a great resource in Harbor of Grace in Harford County, Maryland, where they can go and do inpatient treatment if they need to. And that's all, we try to keep it as confidential and as low key as possible for them. That's why I'm not wearing a uniform today. We don't wear uniforms. I drive in a black Jeep Grand Cherokee. I don't wear a uniform because I've had somebody call me on the way to work and say, hey, I'm really depressed. I'm having a really tough time. Can you meet me? And I go and meet them in a fast food parking lot or at a diner or something of that sort. And if you're going through something and you're experiencing that trauma, you don't want to be seen with somebody in a full uniform and a police car. You just want to have that low-key approach to it. So sure. We try to make sure that we don't stigmatize them further by having that.
So what moved you into that position? What motivated you to kind of look into this and say, hey, this is something I really want to do?
So throughout the years, just like everybody else, I've had my share of traumas, coworkers that have died in the line of duty, coworkers that have died off duty, just experiencing the everyday stressors of law enforcement. I like to tell the story to the recruits. I was actually a police explorer at 14 years old. And my very first call when I went on a ride along was a gentleman who had committed suicide in a baseball field with a shotgun. So at 14 years old, that's what I was exposed to. And it's just gone from there. In addition, I was in a major car crash in 2004 where I almost died and was almost paralyzed. I was able to make a great comeback, but experiencing that gave me a better appreciation for what a lot of people experience, whether they go through a car crash, whether they're involved in an officer-involved shooting or whatever it is, that they need that support and they need somebody there that they can talk to, that they can confide in, and that they can seek to get that help. Because a lot of times during critical incidents or something like that, in the very beginning, you have a lot of support, right? Everybody's showing up. The politicians are showing up. The bosses are showing up. Your friends are showing up. But the further you get into that, the less people show up. Mm-hmm. So when I was in my crash, I was in shock trauma for 2 weeks. Everybody's there. Mm-hmm. I was in rehab. Some people were there, but a lot that kind of fell off. And then as it got a little further, as I was rehabbing at home, you start to see less and less people. And you start to feel kind of lonely. And then, you know, that dark place where you're like, what am I going to do? You know, this is my career. And I came on at 21 years old and my only other real skill was infantry. So I didn't have any other real job skills. So, you know, I'm kind of sitting there like, what am I going to do if I can't recover to come back to work? Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, a lot of people encounter that. So that brought me to a place where I was able to continue on in my career and do a lot of great things throughout my tenure. But I got to the mobile crisis team, which is our 24-hour co-responder model team that goes out into the field and helps people in crisis. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, while I was there, this position was coming open. And I was like, you know what? I want to go and try and help people the best I can, because if I can just help one person make a difference, then that's what really matters.
What kind of training or education did you need to have to get into this position?
So we originally had some basic standards that we put in place, and we've kind of expanded those since then. Crisis intervention team training, so being able to deal with people in crisis and understand different types of people. So people with intellectual disabilities or Alzheimer's or veterans, especially veterans. We have a program through the governor's office in Maryland that allows us to get training on how to interact with veterans who are experiencing crisis and PTS. In addition to that, the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. So crisis intervention stress management is something that we make everybody go through. We just did instinctual trauma response, which is kind of, it's been around for a long time, but it is not something that has been widespread. And that uses the graphic narrative and externalized dialogue to help people get through their trauma. And the whole purpose of that is to get people through to process it and have the tools to be able to handle it so they're not in therapy for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. And what they say is the hand will draw what the mind does not remember. So a lot of times, you know, when your brain goes offline during a critical incident and you have that cortisol in your system, you piecemeal together what happened. Mm-hmm. And the graphic narrative works you through it in a chronological order so you can have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you can process that trauma. And we've actually had great success with that here. With a lot of our members who have been in officer-involved shootings and other traumatic events. Also through the Cortico app, we have it's the National Emergency Responder Learning Program, I believe it is, and they have a peer certification as well that I'm making everyone go through. Mm-hmm.
So what has been the difference between before you had this kind of a program and now? What's been the difference in your retention rates? What's been the difference in officer health and that kind of thing? Have you seen a difference in those responses?
So as we all know, law enforcement has been a kind of a roller coaster for a while now. I'd say at least a decade. Some may say shorter than that. So we still have ups and downs when it comes to recruiting and retention, trying to get people to stay. But getting the word out and making sure that people are taken care of, making sure that supervisors and executives understand that it's not about them, it's about the people and taking care of the people and having that servant leadership and providing everyone with the tools to be able to deal with their traumas and their stressors, making sure they have financial assistance, literacy type stuff, making sure that they know the phone numbers that they can call if they need mental health help. Making sure that they're staying physically healthy has been a big campaign for me lately to make sure people get physicals and also cardiac testing, because we're at a higher rate for heart disease than a lot of other professions, has had a very big impact. A lot of people have been contacting me about, hey, what did you send out about cardiac testing? And, you know, I'm going to go make sure I get calcium scoring and all that. So I would say that we've seen a lower instance of people having grander issues. Mm-hmm. So we've had, unfortunately, we've had suicides in our department. We've had people who have had mental health episodes that have cost them their job. And by providing this information, we've seen a lot less of that in at least the recent year, I would say.
Mm-hmm. With an agency that size, with all those people, men and women, you know, how do you kind of monitor, or how do you care for, I guess is a better word, the individual that's perhaps, you know, the lower ranking, the, you know, day to day, how does that individual get cared for?
So that all starts when we train the supervisors. So when they get promoted, so our ranks are officer, corporal, sergeant, lieutenant, and so on and so forth. And when they first get promoted to corporal all the way through, when they get promoted, we go in and talk to them at every stage and provide them with new information related to stress management and trauma. So we put that into place so that way they can recognize if they're people. And what I always say is, you don't necessarily need us to come out if somebody is having an issue, right? Because they know you, they trust you, you're probably their mentor. You can help them with that, and you can call us and we'll give you resources and information and assistance that helps on that day-to-day basis. So really, it's about having that organic, almost peer support team out there and the supervision, keeping track of everybody. It also goes along with making sure, again, we touch them on their second day of the academy. So right when they're first in, we give them stress management training. Right before they go out for field training, we check in with them again, see how they're doing, how they're coping, what techniques they use. Do they use mindfulness? Are they eating healthy? What kind of stuff do they have in place? And we make sure that they have the tools to be able to monitor each other, right? Because at the end of the day, we're all the same. And it's about us monitoring each other and making sure we're all okay. And I like to show them a video on the first day of Michael Phelps, where ESPN did a video about his mental health struggles. Mm-hmm. And at the very end of that video, he says, people see us as heroes. People see us as superheroes. And really, at the end of the day, we're just people. And it's almost the same thing with law enforcement. People expect us to be almost at that superhero level. Like, we're going to swoop in. We don't have feelings. We're going to take care of the problem. We're going to roll out. But unfortunately, that's not the case. We are, at the end of the day, we experience the same thing everybody else experiences, and we engage in the same activities. So we have to have that support in place. Mm-hmm.
So over the course of the years that you've been doing this, have you seen a shift in the willingness to talk about these things among the rank and file?
Absolutely. You know, even 10 years ago, you would never have people talk about their feelings. That was seen as being weak. They were scared that if they talked about having a mental or emotional health issue, that, or even really a physical issue, that they would have their gun taken, that they would be suspended. And, you know, that, unfortunately, that happened often back in those days. And when that would happen, when you get suspended, they send an email out to everybody to let them know you're not supposed to be in a facility and all that kind of stuff. So we've had a significant change in that. That doesn't happen anymore. That only happens if you commit a significant crime or something that, you know, requires you to not be there. Mm-hmm. If you're suffering some kind of trauma or mental health or emotional health issue, we seek to get you the assistance before we really try to take any of those routes. And sometimes for their safety, we may still, you know, take their gun to secure it somewhere safe. But we're not going to send that mass email out saying, you know, don't let this person in the building and all that kind of stuff. So reducing that stigma has really been very positive for everybody. And we still have a lot of work to do. There's always going to be work to do. Mm-hmm. But just seeing that significant shift has allowed people to kind of build that trust, getting to know them. So we go to every in-service every week now. So we get to see everybody come through. And they get to see your face, they get to know you, they get to talk to you, and they trust you, so they're more willing to speak to you. I will say we work in a multi-generational career. So you have people from 18 years old all the way up to people in their 60s. Mm. Even some of our retired officers have come back as what we call a police assistant. So they'll work in an administrative job like cameras and technology and stuff like that. And so we have people here in their 80s. So from 18 to 80s is a big gap, right? Sure. And everybody knows that multi-generational is something a lot of employers have trouble dealing with. But it's how you interact with folks and how you approach them. And so the younger generations, they tend to want to speak more about their feelings, which is great. They're more in touch with that. It allows them to process their traumas a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. the older generation, you know, we still have some folks who don't want to talk about their feelings, but they will talk to you if they know you and trust you. Mm-hmm. So they may not be willing to talk about it in a group setting if we're doing a debrief or something like that after a critical incident, but they'll be willing to come to your office and close the door and sit there and talk to you. Mm-hmm. So we've had a lot of success with the whole range of ages and people coming to us. And I made sure that when I got here that we diversified the team when we added those 30 people. So we have LGBTQIA+. We have, all ethnicities, all races. We try to cover everybody. So that way, if you don't feel comfortable speaking with me, but you feel comfortable speaking with somebody who's more similar to you, we have that in place. Mm-hmm. So that way you can do that. Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes peer support is, you know, really focused on those men and women who are the workforce out on the street. They're the ones that are, you know, the public facing folks. What about those commanders? What about the people that are the higher up in ranks? They're smaller numbers. They tend to be more isolated. How are they supported in their journey?
So we make sure to support everybody. When I talk to them all, we actually just did a presentation for all of our executives about a month ago, where I provided them with all of the stress management information, all of the resources, all of the tools. I know pretty much all of them on a pretty good basis. So they know that they can come if they have an issue, that it's not just for people that are of lower ranks or who are not executives. Anybody can come at any time and we will help them through whatever they need. It's all the same resources. There's always going to be that level of disconnect, if you will, between those on the street and those in the offices and managing. But we try to break that and try to make sure. And our training team has actually done something unique this year where the commanders are now coming in to in-service trainings with the officers and with the supervisors to be alongside them. Mm-hmm. And what I always say to them is, you know, if you're going to be out in uniform, because they wear their uniforms every day, what are you going to do if something happens? You know, are you going to drive past it, or are you going to pop in? Right. And the culture has shifted greatly. So now they are more than happy to assist or get out on a traffic stop or help out a call or whatever they need to do. And that visibility has allowed everybody to be more cohesive. Cause you know, it can be difficult sometimes, right? They almost always feel isolated. So making sure that they have the trainings, they have access to everything I put out, all the trainings we arrange, all the events we arrange is for everybody. It's not just for the officers. It's also for professional staff as well. So we include all of our office assistants and directors and professional staff as well, who are often forgotten, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a story or an anecdote of someone who kind of came into your office or you guys helped through a process and now is thriving out there in the force?
So we had, we've unfortunately had a number of officer involved shootings recently. And what we do when that happens is we go out with the FOP and we make sure that those officers are not feeling isolated. We make sure that they get information on the process as to what's going to happen. And we've had some officers who have been involved in a number of critical incidents, officer involved shootings. So that can really affect you when you've taken several lives or you've seen some stuff that most people will never see in their lifetime. So we've had some and we've been able to send them to get professional assistance as well. And then we work with them. We check on them leading up at the very beginning, almost on a daily basis, sometimes maybe multiple times a day. And then we make sure to check in with them weekly and as they go through that process. And so we try to make sure that they and their families are as supported as possible. And then on the backside of it, once they get through that and they've kind of processed their trauma and everything's been in place, you know, now they're able to come back. Now they're able to thrive, whether it's in a line function or not. We're very good. This department's very good about making sure that if you've been in a critical incident and it's really caused you post-traumatic stress that could really affect you, that we're going to find somewhere for you to be productive and still be a member of the agency. But it's not a line function where you may be exposed to additional traumas mm-hmm. or to something like that again. Mm-hmm. And so without being too specific, because the whole peer support is confidentiality, sure, absolutely, is the number one thing. You know, we've had somebody who's done that. and who is now on their way back to working in a productive area, whether it's going to be training or somewhere else, that they'll be able to help others who may encounter something like what they encountered in the future. And it's almost organic peer support as well, because now that person can pass along what worked for them and how that affected them going through that process.
You know, I'm aware of a situation that where an officer in a certain jurisdiction was involved in a shooting where this officer was hit with bullets in their vest and now have been off duty for 2 years, still not able to go back to work. And the agency is just kind of like, whatever, you know, and they're kind of out there on their own. And now we're like, do I need to get a lawyer? You know, what do I do? Right. You know, how does that kind of, what should happen and how should an agency, you know, reach out and help that person along?
I mean, that person should be supported from the moment it happens, especially if they were shot in the line of duty, whether it went into their person or into their vest, it doesn't matter, right? Yep. Because it's the processing of the trauma that your brain does that is really what's going to cause you the greatest harm. Mm-hmm. So really something like that, they should be supported from the moment it starts for both them and their family. And to make sure that they're still included and they're part of the getting regular updates. They're part of what's going on. People are reaching out to keep them in the loop, to find out how they are doing, find out how they're recovering and what can be done to help them recover. Some people bounce back quickly. I mean, I almost died in a car crash. I was back in 5 months, very fortunate. Some people takes years. And it's just because they have trouble processing through that trauma, or they may not be getting the proper level of care. And so you can't keep that person in limbo and expect them to get better and become back and be productive and to want to come back quickly if they're not getting the support that they deserve or need.
Right. So what were the things that helped you that you did? What were those perhaps even daily practices that you engage in, perhaps still do, to kind of keep you healthy and to keep you on a journey of wellness throughout your life?
So obviously, everybody knows physical fitness is priority for keeping you healthy and well, and for your brain function and for really every system in your body. So whether it's walking, whether that's all you can do, or whether it's a hardcore workout, you know, CrossFit, that sort of thing, just daily exercise, something always to engage in, getting your steps in, right? Everybody's got a smart watch nowadays. I got mine here. It'll tell me how many steps I walk. You know, something as simple as that. And I encourage that. I can actually look out my window almost any time of day and see a group of people doing a wellness walk around the parking lot, which is about a quarter mile. Nutrition, making sure you're eating right and not eating terribly. I bring with me broccoli and hummus or an apple and peanut butter or something like that to eat throughout the day. So I'm not tempted to go out to Starbucks and get a 700 calorie burrito, get that, you know, 1,000 calorie latte, that sort of thing. Drinking water, obviously, hydration, very, very important for all of your bodily functions, including your brain activity, mindfulness. And everybody, you know, I was actually listening to your other podcast earlier with the doctor from Australia. I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but, you know, he was talking about hippy dippy stuff. Well, it's true. A lot of people find it that way, and it's not. When they actually get to do it and get to know it, and I've talked to people who have that kind of warrior mindset that you never in a million years, they're the 6'4", you know, strong person that you see, and you'd never in a million years think, and you talk to them and they're like, you know what, I sit down and I journal at night, or I just enjoy sitting and doing breathing techniques, or I do yoga or whatever it is. You know, just trying to take time for yourself to be able to sit and calmly enjoy time, whether it's outside, whether it's inside, or whatever you do, helps to reset your brain, helps to reset that cognitive function. And so I'll just take time throughout the day. Maybe I'll just stand in the driveway for 10 minutes and stare up at the sky out in the country and just enjoy what's around, enjoy nature. It's very quiet. It's very peaceful. So what it's really up to whatever anybody, you know, is their thing, but you need to practice some kind of mindfulness.
You have to do something, right? And you have to try it. And right now, I just picked up a book the other day that is all about trying new things in very small doses. Just start small and just do little things, you know, like this one of the stories that he says, you know, he said when he first started flossing, he didn't want to floss, but he knew that it was a good thing. So I flossed one tooth, he said. Just one tooth. Just got in the habit of doing that one tooth every day. And finally it led to him, you know, flossing his whole mouth, you know. But he said, you got to start someplace. So you got to start small. So maybe you don't want to take a 30-minute walk. Well, you can take a 5-minute walk. You know, just start those small practices that get you in the habit of doing the things that will get you to where you want to go. And I think that's so important to keep those daily things and to be consistent with it.
Absolutely. So we actually, through our employee assistance program, are partnered with a company called O2X, who's a tactical athlete human performance company. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, we were able to offer some seminars for people to go through just recently. And they teach you all of that, but their mantra is 1% changes. Mm-hmm. So just making that 1% change and then building upon it, so that way you get a little better every day and you can not overwhelm yourself with trying to, I'm going to go to the gym every day. No.
Yeah.
Go to the gym twice a week to start, then maybe 3 days a week, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. It's like when I was on my bike ride last summer, we'd go up a big, huge hill and it was hard. And all I did was I looked ahead 10 feet and I found a spot 10 feet ahead and I rode to that spot. And I knew if I could ride to that spot, hey, that was a win, right? And then I picked another spot 10 feet ahead and rode to that spot. And pretty soon I was at the top of the hill.
Right.
It's just,
absolutely.
Kind of taking those little
just
bites.
Those little goals, just make the little goals. And once you achieve them, the next thing you know, you're 100 miles down the road and you don't even realize it.
Yeah. So I know recently you were with Vance Rowe and his yoga work. So tell me about that and what did you guys do and how did it affect the folks that are in your care?
So we had Vance come up as part of our peer support team orientation. And he did his class on overcoming calming seas and how he went through his traumas. And then he led us through about a half an hour-ish of yoga. And you have people of all body types, physical fitness levels and everything else, just kind of engaging in yoga. And, you know, at the end, everybody kind of came together and you kind of do that cool down period or that restful period where you just lay and just be. And, you know, people found it to be very effective and found it to kind of help them reset from where they were. Right. Because, you know, it's a lot of heavy topics, especially when you're talking about trying to help people and that kind of stuff. So being able to get through that and get to that end, that restful moment, just relaxes you. Mm-hmm. So we actually are going to have Vance come back to one of our FOP peer-to-peer meetings that we have, where it's a group meeting. Anybody can come to and speak, and he's going to do some yoga for us there as well. Mm-hmm. So we can try and continue getting that word out. Because again, yoga is one of those things where you're either really into it or you're somebody who's like, yoga, I'm not going on put on spandex and be in a room full of people. Right. So we actually have been promoting that at our in-service. So they go through that critical incident and they come out at the top and it's the mindfulness moment. And we allow them time to lay down on a mat. They can stretch if they want. They can take a nap if they want. I tell them when they come out of the door that it's probably the only time in their career they may get paid to take a 20-minute nap. But it's about being in that moment and having that time to sit down and reflect and relax and de-stress. And everybody seems to be very open to it at this point.
And so what do you guys do? I know you talked about at the academy when recruits are going through the training and you bring in family members. What do you do today for officers and their families? Do you do things for families? How does that work?
So right now we're in the process of trying to organize like a family day, probably at the equine therapy farm, where people can bring and we have different things like they've had a bonfire there and stuff like that, where people can bring their families, their children, everybody, and they can kind of come together, people who don't know each other, and bond and experience those activities, but also experience tips or tricks, right, that might help them with mindfulness as a family while they're experiencing everything else. So you may come out to the farm just to have an enjoyable day, but you may be interacting with the horses and now you understand, hey, this is very relaxing for me. Maybe we need to do more of this or try to get out here more often or as a family. In addition to that, there are different groups we try to get out and speak to. We're trying to bring, and we don't, haven't seen it too many places, but we're trying to bring spouses and family into the team atmosphere. And I'm not quite sure how to do that yet. I've been working with the International Association of the Chiefs of Police and some other people that have done some stuff like that in the past. But again, it's trying to bring everybody in, but also trying to maintain and not let it be chaotic. Because if you grow something very large and there's not the structure in place to handle it, you're going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. Also, in the near future, we're looking at trying to have a day where they can bring their spouses or partners or significant others in. And it can be where they can learn about financial literacy. They can learn about mindfulness and how the brain works and trauma and all that kind of stuff. So that way, the spouse or the partner or significant other understands what their first responder may be going through. Because let's be honest, you know, everybody's different, right? So my wife works in human resources. She's lucky enough to have her own business and to work from home. And so she doesn't understand responding to a child death and then immediately going to a homicide scene and then going to a parking complaint. And then you come home and now you've seen all this trauma throughout the day and how it works. So making sure that the spouses understand that, you know, your first responder may come home and may have cumulative stress and may be short with you or may need 20 minutes to process what's going on before they're really ready to interact with you is very important. Mm-hmm. So that way you can maintain that healthy relationship instead of the unfortunate history of law enforcement and having kind of not the best run with relationships.
Mm-hmm. I recently recorded a podcast with Darren Purcell, and it's actually going to go up on the podcast next week. So it come out before this episode comes out. But he is a retired firefighter out of Orange County, California. And he, with the help of his church, they started a support group for first responders, and which is really growing. It's kind of blowing up there in Orange County. And then his wife started a support group for wives of first responders. And that's been a huge, huge thing as well. And so I think some things like that could be beneficial for that. They're kind of run like AA. They're not AA, but they're kind of run like that, where it's, you know, it's secret. It's you don't know, you know, no one talks about, you know, what happens there stays there, you know, that kind of thing. And it's really helpful for these first responders and their spouses. And is that something that you guys could perhaps someone could start that in your community or in your area?
Absolutely. I mean, we're always open to anything that will help people. So our FOP peer-to-peer meetings currently are open to anybody. So we've had spouses come to those before and kind of work through the traumas that they've experienced with their first responder. But starting something completely separate or starting something outside of that would be great, because that way they can come together and kind of decompress without that first responder in the room, right? Like, you know, you're kind of trying to talk about what happened, but you also at the same time don't feel comfortable because the person's sitting right next to you. So we would absolutely be open to that, probably through our FOP, just because, like any good government organization, you know, sometimes bureaucracy takes a while to get things moving. But the FOP, is that something that you could arrange?
They can move pretty quickly. Yeah. Very good. Well, so I want to ask a couple more questions before we wrap up here. What's one of the biggest stressors for your officers out there?
I think just life stressors, unfortunately, gets in the way a lot of times, and then it just gets compounded when they come to work. So, you know, even though we are very, very well paid, I will say, I mean, we do very good in that arena. People still sometimes live outside their means, don't know how to properly save money or work with their money to make sure it goes to where it needs to go. And so you have a lot of people that are living paycheck to paycheck, which causes stress. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of internal, maybe family struggle or something like that. You know, maybe you have a child who has a health issue, or maybe you have something that causes family stress. And then that family stress comes into the workplace, and now you get the cumulative stress from the job. And I think it just is really just one giant circle of a lot of things coming together. And then it's also, you know, how people perceive what's going on in their world, right? Everybody's an individual. So do they feel supported? Do they feel like they're progressing in their job or their career? Do they feel like they know what path they're on? I mean, a lot of people, when we, 20 years ago, when I came on 24 years ago, people knew that this was the career they were going to stay in for the rest of their life, pretty much, right? You do 30 years, you do 35 years, and then you retire and you get your pension. And, you know, maybe you do something afterwards, maybe you don't. That's something different. Now, a lot of people, they're looking to see what's out there because there's a lot of competition. There's a lot going on in the world, and they may come and stay 5 years and say, you know what, this isn't for me. I'm going to move on to the private sector, or this department's not for me. I'm going to go somewhere else because they're paying better. So there's a lot of stressors out there, and they all come together. And really, it's individualized to the person themselves, because as was mentioned in one of your previous podcasts, adverse childhood experiences also cause a lot of trauma as well. So that comes into the whole picture, is how you were raised, what kind of childhood you had, what you experienced in your childhood can also go into your career and your adult life.
So how do you and your team, you face all these things, you hear all these things, you're helping people. How do you guys stay healthy and well?
So we do what we practice, what we preach. So, we don't talk about the people that we encounter, again, because confidentiality is key, and that's what builds trust. But we will decompress. We'll talk in generic terms about, just things that we encounter, our life stressors, and kind of work them out. We practice the mindfulness. We practice those tips and tricks that we spoke about earlier that are out there to be able to help you. And we just try to make sure that we do all of the things that if we tell somebody to do it, that we're doing it as well. We're getting our annual physicals, we're getting cardiac checkups, we're doing all of those things to make sure that we are well, so that way we can help others. And there are days, the honest truth is there are days when we are stressed out as well. And we're trying to help you and we're stressed, but again, at the end of the day, we're human and we're going to encounter the same things that everyone else is going to encounter. So it's just trying to make sure that we know how to work through that issue, that stress or that trauma to get to the other side.
So John, as you wrap up here, what's one thing someone can do? Perhaps they're in another agency across the country someplace and they don't have what you guys have there at Baltimore. What's one thing that they can do to kind of move their agency in that direction?
So even our program, which is a great program right now, is still undergoing a renaissance, if you will, right? There are other places that have whole wellness centers for their police departments that are light years ahead of everyone else. There are places that don't have anybody. So we are lucky enough in this region, working with Vance, that we have put together a regional list where it's almost every state in the or every county in the state. There are some partner agencies outside of the state, and we are able to connect and talk to each other and work together to share ideas and share how our programs are going and our standard operating procedures and trainings that we feel are good or necessary. And so, I would tell them, just make sure you're reaching out to your partners. Try to find, whether it's through LinkedIn or whether it's through word of mouth or the, IACP or whoever it is, try to find partner agencies that you can reach out to and get information from. We're all going to start from scratch at some point, and there's, going to be continual improvement throughout. The Law Enforcement Mental Health and Wellness Act grant, we got that recently, a couple years ago, and that's great because they have a consortium that comes together once a quarter. And you can see what all the departments are doing. And you can kind of say, that might work here or that might not work here. So just network. Networking is probably the best thing you can do. And then once you get that information, do your research, do your due diligence, and then push. And all you can do is keep pushing, right? I mean, like any good leader that's going to come through, just keep pushing. And eventually you'll make small improvements and you'll get to where you need to be.
Awesome. Well, with that, we'll leave it there. So, John, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today on this. Congratulations on what you guys are doing. And I look forward to working with you guys in the near future to bring the film to your community and to help you guys move forward in any way I can. So if there's anything I can do for you, please let me know.
Yes, thank you very much for having me today. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be here. And we look forward to having our community learn more about the stressors of first responders through the PTSD 911 movie.
Thanks, John, for spending time with me on the podcast. And don't forget, if you would like to host a screening of PTSD 911, you can do that by visiting our website and filling out the screening form. That's PTSD911movie.com. Go check it out. A big thanks to all of you who have taken time to listen, to watch, and especially those of you who have left a review. I really appreciate it, and I read every single one. If you haven't left a review yet, please do so. I want to be sure I'm bringing you content that you want to hear, and so your reviews help me do that. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can always dial 988, and there's someone there who will listen. Be sure to tune in next week for another interview with an amazing first responder leader. Until then, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.